asking me to copy. The manner was more like a painting than writing, very expressive, running down like cloud-swept branches. You could tell that whoever had written this was an artist, cultured and deserving of respect. Reluctantly, I admitted to myself that this calligraphy must have been Precious Auntie's. At last, old Widow Lau was done haggling with the driver, and we stepped inside Father's shop. It was north-facing, quite dim inside, and perhaps this was why Father did not see us at first. He was busy with a customer, a man who was distinguished-looking, like the scholars of two decades before. The two men were bent over a glass case, discussing the different qualities of ink sticks. Big Uncle welcomed us and invited us to be seated. From his formal tone, I knew he did not recognize who we were. So I called his name in a shy voice, and he squinted at me, and then laughed and announced our arrival to Little Uncle, who apologized many times for not rushing over sooner to greet us. They rushed us to be seated at one of the two tea tables for customers. Old Widow Lau refused their invitation three times, exclaiming that my father and uncles must be too busy for visitors. She made weak efforts to leave. On the fourth insistence, we finally sat. Then Little Uncle brought us hot tea and sweet oranges, as well as bamboo latticework fans with which to cool ourselves. I tried to notice everything so I could later tell Gao Ling what I had seen and tease out her envy. The floors of the shop were of dark wood, polished and clean, no dirty footprints, even though this was during the dustiest part of the summer. And along the walls were display cases made of wood and glass. The glass was very shiny, and not one pane was broken. Within those glass cases were our silk-wrapped boxes, all our hard work. They looked so much nicer than they had in the ink-making studio at Immortal Heart Village. I saw that Father had opened several of the boxes. He set sticks and cakes and other shapes on a silk cloth covering a glass case that served as a table on which he and the customer leaned. First he pointed to a stick with a top shaped like a ferry boat and said with graceful importance, "Your writing will flow as smoothly as a keel cutting through a glassy lake." He picked up a bird shape. "Your mind will soar into the clouds of higher thought." He waved toward a row of ink cakes embellished with designs of peonies and bamboo. "Your ledgers will blossom into abundance while bamboo surrounds your quiet mind." As he said this, Precious Auntie came back into my mind. I was remembering how she taught me that everything, even ink, had a purpose and a meaning. Good ink cannot be the quick kind, ready to pour out of a bottle. You can never be an artist if your work comes without effort. That is the problem with modern ink from a bottle. You do not have to think. You simply write what is swimming on the top of your brain. And the top is nothing but pond scum, dead leaves, and mosquito spawn. But when you push an ink stick along an inkstone, you take the first step to cleansing your mind and your heart. You push and you ask yourself, "What are my intentions? What is in my heart that matches my mind?" I remembered this, and yet that day in the ink shop, I listened to what Father was saying, and his words became far more important than anything Precious Auntie had thought. "Look here," Father said to his customer, and I looked. He held up an ink stick and rotated in the light. "See, it's the right hue, purple-black. Not brown or gray like the cheap brands you might find down the street." I listened to this, and I heard a sound as clean and pure as a small silver bell. The high-pitched tone tells you that the soot is very fine, as smooth as the sliding banks of old rivers. And the scent, can you smell the balance of strength and delicacy, the musical notes of the ink's perfume? Expensive. And everyone who sees you using it will know that it was well worth the high price. I was very proud to hear Father speak of our family's ink this way. I sniffed the hot air. The smell of spices and camphor was very strong. "This suit," Father continued, is far better than Anhui pine. We make it from a kind of tree so rare that it's now forbidden to chop it down. Luckily, we have a supply felled by lightning, blessed by the gods. Father asked a customer if he had heard about the ancient human skullcap recently unearthed from the quarry at Dragon Bone Hill. The old scholar nodded. "Well, we're from the village one hill over," Father explained. "And the trees in our village are said to be more than 1 million years old. How do we know? Think about it. When those million-year-old folks roamed earth around Dragon Bone Hill, did they need trees to sit under? Trees for shade, trees to make fires, trees to build stools and tables and beds. Am I right? Well then, we, the people from the village next to Dragon Bone Hill, supplied that need. And now we're the ones who own the remains of those ancestral trees. We call them immortal heartwood." Father motioned to the shelves. "Now look here. On this shelf, there's only 1 pinch per stick, so the cost is less. In this row, 2 pinches. And in this case, it is almost entirely the soot of immortal tree wood. The ink draws easily into the brush like nectar into the butterfly's nostril." In the end, the customer bought several of the most expensive sticks and left the shop. I wanted to clap, as if I had just seen a play for the gods. And then Father was coming toward us, toward me. I rose from the chair with a leaping heart. I had not seen him since Great Granny's funeral more than 3 months before. I wondered if he would say anything about my more grown-up appearance. "What? Is it already 5 o'clock in the evening?" he asked. This caused old Widow Lau to jump and cry. "We're too early. We should leave and come back later." That was how I learned what time we were supposed to come. 5 o'clock, not 1. Old Widow Lau was so upset by this open announcement of her mistake that my father had to insist 5 times that she be seated again. And then my uncle brought more tea and more oranges. But still, everything was awkward. After a while, Father expressed his care and his concern for me. "You look too thin," he said. Or perhaps he said I was looking quite plump. Next, he asked after the health of my mother, and then that of Gao Ling and my younger brothers, and then that of the various aunts and in-laws. "Good. Well, fine," I chattered like a duck. Wearing those new clothes, it was hard for me to answer in a natural way. Finally, he asked if I had eaten yet. And although I was hungry enough to faint, I had no chance to answer, for old Widow Lau was crying, "We've eaten. We're full enough to burst. Oh, please don't let us be any more trouble. Go on with your work." "We're not busy at all," Father answered out of politeness. "Not too busy for family." And old Widow Lau answered even more politely. "Really, we must go. But before we leave, have you heard what happened to..." And she started talking nervously of some distant relations. After old Widow Lau had mentioned at least 5 or 6 more relatives, my father set down his teacup and stood up. "Cousin Lau, where are my manners? I shouldn't force you to entertain me any longer. I know you came early so you and my daughter could wander the city streets and become lost in marvelous sights." He handed me a few coins for sweets and dumplings, warning me I should treat Elder Aunt well and not wear her out. "Take your time," he told her. "No need to rush back for our sake." Old Widow Lau was embarrassed to be dismissed in this clever way. I was overjoyed, and soon we were outside in the festering heat. Down the lane we found a dumpling stall where we could sit on outdoor benches. As I gobbled down my dumplings, old Widow Lau complained that the hot dampness was swelling her feet. "Soon they'll be as soft and useless as rotted bananas." She was too frugal to take a rickshaw home to Lantern Market Street, only to have to turn around and come back. But she worried aloud that when we returned to the shop at 5 o'clock, we would have our accidental meeting with someone important. And there we would be, mouths open, tongues out, panting like worm-infested gutter dogs. "Don't sweat," she warned me. We started walking, searching for shade. I listened to old Widow Lau's complaints with one ear as I watched people pass us on the streets. Young men who appeared to be students or apprentices. Old Manchu women with heavy bundles. Girls with short modern hairstyles and Western clothes. Everyone walked with purpose, a quick step that was not the style of people back home. Now and then, old Willow Lau pushed my shoulder and snapped, "Hey, don't gawk like you're an old greasy hat from the countryside." And so we continued our ramble, two streets east, then two streets north, then two streets east again. That was the method my old cousin took to avoid our getting lost. Soon we found ourselves in a park with weeping willows and walkways over a pond covered with floating flowers and twitching lava. Old Widow Lau sat down on a bench under the shade of a tree and began to fan herself vigorously, complaining that she was going to explode like an overbaked yam. In a short while, her jaw dropped into her chest and she was asleep. Close by was an open-air pavilion made of dark wood lattice screens and rows of column posts supporting its heavy tiled roof. I went to a corner of the pavilion and squeezed against the post, trying to make myself still and unseen like a lizard. From there, I watched a man mastering his mind over his sword. I saw an old man blowing musical notes out of a metal comb, while the old woman beside him peeled an orange and tried to catch a butterfly that dipped and swooped toward the rind. Down a flight of stairs, a young couple sat by a small pond, pretending to admire ducks while the tips of their fingers secretly touched. There was also a foreigner, although I did not recognize him as such at first, for he was dressed in the clothes of a scholar, a long summer gown and trousers. His eyes were gray like muddy water. Around another pillar, a nursemaid was cooing to a baby, trying to get him to look at her. But the baby was screaming, trying to look back at the foreigner. And then another man, very elegant in his dress and manners, walked to a tree and parted the curtains of a cage I had not even noticed before. Birds immediately began to sing. I felt that I had entered a world 1,000 years old and that I had always been there, but only just now had opened my eyes to see it. I stayed until the pavilion was nearly empty, and then I heard old Widow Lau bellowing my name. "You scared my body right out of my skin," she scolded and pinched my arm hard. As we walked back to my father's shop, I was a different girl. My head was a sandstorm, ideas and hopes whirling about freely. I was wondering all the while what those people at the pavilion would remember the next day and the day after that. Because I knew I would never forget a moment of that day, the day I was to begin my new life. Just as old Widow Lau had planned, my prospective mother-in-law accidentally passed by the shop promptly at 5 o'clock. The woman was younger than mother. She had a stern countenance and was critical-looking. On her wrists she wore much gold and jade to show how valuable she was. When old Widow Lau called to her, she acted puzzled at first, and then delighted. "What luck that we should run into you here!" old Widow Lau cried in a high voice. "When did you arrive in Peking?" "Oh, visiting a cousin? How are things back in Immortal Heart?" After we had recovered from our fake surprise, old Widow Lau introduced the woman to father and my uncles. I was concentrating so hard on not showing any expression whatsoever that I did not hear the woman's name. "This is my cousin's eldest daughter, Liu Luling," old Widow Lau said. "She's 15. "I'm 14, I corrected, and old Widow Lau gave me a scolding glance before adding, "Almost 15. She's visiting Peking this week. The family lives in Immortal Heart Village as well, but they sell their ink in Peking. And as you can see," she said, sweeping her hand out to indicate the shop, "their business is doing not too bad." "In part, we have your husband to thank," father then said. "We buy much of our excellent wood from him." "Really?" old Widow Lau and the woman said at once. My ears turned toward him, curious now that our family knew this family. "That's correct. We get the camphor wood from Mr. Chang," father continued. "And he has also supplied us with coffins on less fortunate occasions. and always of the best quality. Chang, the coffin maker. As exclamations of more surprise and pleasure rang out, I could imagine precious auntie pounding the air with her fists. She would never allow me to marry into this family, and then I reminded myself that this was not her decision to make. We, too, are thinking of starting a business in Peking, Mrs. Chang said. Is that so? Perhaps we can help you in some way, Father said politely. We wouldn't want to trouble you, Mrs. Chan said. No trouble at all, Father countered. You should get together and discuss the possibility, old Widow Lau suggested at just the right moment. As Mrs. Chang paused to think of the excellence of this idea, Father added, In any case, I've been eager to talk to your husband more about the dragon bones he contributed to the great scientific discovery of Peking Man. Mrs. Chan nodded. We were astonished that those ugly little bones were so valuable. Luckily, we didn't eat them up as medicine. I was thinking what it would mean if I married into this rich and famous family. Gaoling would be spitting with envy. Mother would treat me with special fondness. Of course, the Changs probably would not allow precious auntie to come as nursemaid to their future grandchildren, especially if she kept spitting and thrashing whenever their name was mentioned. At the end, it was decided that old Widow Lau, my father, and I should visit a house in Peking belonging to Chang's cousin, where we could see some unusual rocks in the garden. This was good news to old Widow Lau, for it meant that the signs were good, that the Changs considered me a prospect. And I was glad, for this meant I could stay longer in Peking. 2 evenings later, we went to the cousin's house for a viewing the moon party. I wore another borrowed dress. I sat quietly and did not eat too much and talked even less. Mr. Chang had come up from Immortal Heart, and he and Father discussed Peking Man. All the pieces of the skull must stay in China, Father said. That is not only proper, it's the agreement with the foreigners. Those foreigners, Chang said. You can't trust them to keep their word. They'll find a way to sneak out some pieces. They'll find excuses, make new treaties, put up pressure. No treaty can change that Peking Man is a Chinese man and should stay where he lived and died. Suddenly, Mr. Chan saw me sitting on a garden stool. Maybe one day you and I can collect more Peking Men together. How would you like that? I nodded eagerly. The next day, I was a contented girl as I rode home. I had never felt such importance. I had not shamed old Widow Lau or my family. In fact, I had been a great success. My father had criticized me in small ways about unimportant matters, so I knew he was proud of me. Old Widow Lau had bragged to her daughters-in-law that I had looks and manners to warrant 10 marriage proposals. She was certain I would receive a marriage offer from the Changs within the week. Though I had yet to meet the Changs' 4th son, who was back in Dragonbone Hill, I knew he was 2 years older than I was. Like the other sons, he was an apprentice in his father's coffin-making business. What's more, there had been talk that he, the youngest son, might expand the coffin-making business to Peking, just as our family had done with the ink business. That meant I would live in Peking. During all these discussions, I did not ask if my future husband was smart, if he was educated, if he was kind. I did not think about romantic love. I knew nothing of that. But I did know that marriage had to do with whether I improved my station in life or made it worse. And to judge by the Chang's manners and the jewelry that Chang's wife wore, I too was about to become a more important person. What could be wrong with that? Mr. Wei had come before dawn to take me back. The sky was dark, and the air was still clear of summer rotting smells. In the cart, I began to dream of all the ways I had to change my life. Of course, I needed new clothes right away, and I should be more careful to keep my face out of the sun. I did not want to look like a dark little peasant girl. After all, we were artisans and merchants from an old clan, very respected. By the time the stars faded and the sun rose, Peking had disappeared from the horizon, and the landscape before me returned to the same dusty dull. Hours later, the car had climbed the last hill that hid Immortal Heart. I could hear the crowing of cocks, the yelling of dogs, all the familiar sounds of our village. Mr. Wei started bellowing a peasant love song loud enough to burst his lungs. As we turned the bend, we came upon Shepherd Wu gathering his flock. The late afternoon sun sliced through the trees and fell on the backs of the sheep. Wu lifted his stick and called a greeting to Mr. Wei and me. Just then his herd turned in one motion, one direction, like a cloud bringing a storm, and I sensed a great danger. I recalled that Mother had once spoken quietly of this shepherd being a widower who needed a new wife to help him run the looms of his wool. I could practically feel the graininess of yellow gobi dust as my fingers picked through the wool. I could smell the lamb stink seeping into my fingers, my bones. And now that I stared at the shepherd with his grin and his upraised stick, I was even more determined that I should marry the son of the Changs. Perhaps the son would turn out to be a one-eyed idiot. So be it. I would still be daughter-in-law to a famous family who ran a business in Peking. As quickly as it takes to snap a twig, that's how fast the mind can turn against what is familiar and dear. There I was, about to arrive at my old home, and I was not filled with sentimental fondness of all I had grown up with. Instead, I noticed the ripe stench of a pig pasture, the pockmarked land dug up by dragonbone dreamseekers, the holes in the walls, the mud by the wells, the dustiness of the unpaved roads. I saw how all the women we passed, young and old, had the same bland face, sleepy eyes that were mirrors of their sleepy minds. Each person's life was the same as the next person's. Each family was as important as the next, which was to say, not very important. They were country people, both naive and practical, slow to change but quick to think that a disturbance of ants on the ground was a sign of bad luck from the gods high above. Even Precious Auntie had become this way in my mind, a sleepy-headed, greasy hat from the country. I remembered a funny saying about life in a slow village. When you have nothing else to do, you can always busy yourself picking maggots out of rice. Once I had laughed at that saying, now I saw that it was true. Mr. Wei was still singing his loud folk songs as we rode into the town square. And then we came to Pig's Head Lane. I passed all the familiar faces and listened to their harsh, dust-choked greetings. As we came closer to the bend of the neck where our house stood, my heart began to drum in my ears. I saw the family gateway, the arch with its peeling timber, the fading red couplet banners that hung on the pillars. But just as I pushed open the gate, my heart flew back into my chest, and I was filled with a longing to see Precious Auntie. She would be so glad to see me. She had cried when I left. I dashed into the front courtyard. I'm home already. I went into the ink studio where I saw Mother and Gao Ling. Ah, back so soon? Mother said, not bothering to stop her work. Cousin Lau sent me a note that the meeting went well, and the Changs will probably take you. I was bursting to tell them about my adventures, the pleasures I had enjoyed, but Mother stopped me. Hurry and clean up, so you can help your little sister and me grind this up. And Gao Ling wrinkled her nose and said, Chou, you smell like the hind end of a donkey. I went to the room I shared with Precious Auntie. Everything was in its usual place. The quilt folded just so at the bottom of the kong, but she was not there. I wandered from room to room, from little courtyard to little courtyard. With each passing moment, I felt more anxious to see her. And then I heard a pot banging. She was in the root cellar, eager that I should know she was there. I peered down the steep ladder and into the tunnel. She waved. And as she climbed up from the shadows, I saw that she still had the figure of a girl. In the brief moment of seeing only half of her face lit by the sun, she was again as beautiful as she had seemed to me when I was a small child. When she emerged from the hole, she put the pot down and stroked my face. then said with her hands, "Have you really come back to me, my doggie?" She pulled my tangled braid and snorted, "Didn't take your comb. No one to remind you? Now you know why you need me. You have no brains." She jabbed the side of my head, and this made me irritable. With spit on her finger, she rubbed dirt from my cheek, then felt my forehead. "Are you sick? You seem feverish." "I'm not sick," I said. "I'm hot." She went back to unraveling the mats of my hair. I glanced at her ropey scars, her twisted mouth. I pulled away. "I can clean myself," I said. She began to make hissing sounds. "Gone 1 week and now you're so grown up?" I snapped back. "Of course. After all, I'm about to be a married woman." "I heard. And not as a concubine, but as a wife. That's good. I raised you well, and everyone can see that." I knew then that Mother had not told her the name of the family. She had to hear it sooner or later. "The family is the Changs," I said, watching the words cut her in two. "That's right. Chang the coffin maker." She sounded as if she were drowning. She rocked her head like a clanging bell. And then she told me with slashing hands, "You cannot. I forbid you." "It's not for you to decide," I shouted back. She slapped me, then pushed me against the wall. Again and again she beat me on my shoulders, around my head, and at first I whimpered and cowered, trying to protect myself. But then I became angry. I pushed her back and stood tall. I drained all expression out of my face, and this surprised her. We stared at each other, breathing hard and fast, until we no longer recognized each other. She dropped onto her knees, pounding her chest over and over, her sign for useless. "I need to go help Mother and Gao Ling," I said, and turned from her and walked away. Ghost. Just as expected, the Changs asked our family if I could join theirs as a daughter-in-law. If I went there right away, Old Widow Lau added, my family would receive a money gift, and I would immediately be known as a daughter-in-law during all the family and town ceremonies, including the special one that would happen during the Moon Festival, honoring Mr. Chang for his scientific achievements. "She should go now," Big Aunt and Little Aunt advised Mother. "Otherwise, they might later change their minds. What if they discover something wrong with her background and want to end the marriage contract?" I thought they were talking about my poor sewing skills or some naughtiness that I had forgotten, but they had not. But of course, they were talking about my birth. They knew whose daughter I really was. The Changs and I did not. Mother decided I would join the Chang family in a few weeks, before the town ceremony at the Moon Festival. She assured me that would give her and my aunts enough time to sew together quilts and clothes suitable for my new life. After Mother announced this news, she cried for joy. "I've done well by you," she said proudly. "No one can complain." Gao Ling cried as well, and though I shed some tears, not all of them were for joy. I would leave my family, my familiar house. I would change from a girl to a wife, a daughter to a daughter-in-law. And no matter how happy I was sure to be, I would still be sad to say goodbye to my old self. Precious Auntie and I continued to share the same room, the same bed, but she no longer drew my bath or brought me sweet water from the well. She did not help me with my hair or worry over my daily health and the cleanliness of my fingernails. She gave no warnings, no advice. She did not talk to me with her hands. We slept at the farthest ends of the Kung away from each other, and if I found myself huddled next to her familiar form, I quietly moved away before she awoke. Every morning she had red eyes, so I knew she had been crying. Sometimes my eyes were red, too. When Precious Auntie was not working in the ink-making studio, she was writing, sheet after sheet after sheet. She sat at her table, grinding the ink stick into the inkstone, thinking what, I could not guess. She dipped her brush and wrote, paused and dipped again. The words flowed without blots or cross-outs or backward steps. A few days before I was supposed to leave to join the Changs, I awoke to find Prashavanti sitting up, staring at me. She raised her hands and began to talk. "Now I will show you the truth." She went to the small wooden cupboard and removed a package wrapped in blue cloth. She put this in my lap. Inside was a thick wad of pages, threaded together with string. She stared at me with an odd expression, then left the room. I looked at the first page. "I was born the daughter of the famous bone setter from the mouth of the mountain," it began. I glanced through the next few pages. They concerned the tradition of her family, the loss of her mother, the grief of her father, all the things she had already told me. And then I saw where it said, "Now I will tell you how bad this man Chang really is." Right away, I threw those pages down. I did not want Precious Auntie poisoning my mind anymore, so I did not read to the end where she said she was my mother. During our evening meal, Precious Auntie acted as if I were once again helpless. She pinched pieces of food with her chopsticks and added these to my bowl. "Eat more," she ordered. "Why aren't you eating? Are you ill? You seem warm. Your forehead is hot. Why are you so pale?" After dinner, we all drifted to the courtyard as usual. Mother and my aunts were embroidering my bridal clothes. Precious Auntie was repairing a hole in my old trousers. She put down the needle and tucked my sleeve. "Did you already read what I wrote?" I nodded, not wishing to argue in front of the others. My cousins, Gao Ling, and I were playing weaving games with strings looped around our fingers. I was making lots of mistakes, which caused Gao Ling to howl with glee that the Changs were getting a clumsy daughter-in-law. Upon hearing this, Precious Auntie threw me stern looks. The evening wore on. The sun went down. The sounds of darkness came. The chirp, creak, and flap of unseen creatures. All too soon it was time for bed. I waited for Precious Auntie to go first. After a long while, when I thought she might already be asleep, I went into the dark room. Immediately, Precious Auntie sat up and was talking to me with her hands. "I can't see what you're saying," I said, and when she went to light the kerosene lamp, I protested. "Don't bother. I'm sleepy. I don't want to talk right now." She lit the lamp anyway. I went to the Kong and lay there. She followed me and set the lamp on the ledge, crouched and stared at me with a glowing face. "Now that you have read my story, what do you feel toward me? Be honest." I grunted, and that little grunt was enough for her to clasp her hands, then bow and praise the goddess of mercy for saving me from the Changs. Before she could give too many thanks, I added, "I'm still going." For a long time, she did not move. Then she began to cry and beat her chest. Her hands moved fast. "Don't you have feelings for who I am?" And I remember exactly what I said to her. "Even if the whole Chang family were murderers and thieves, I would join them just to get away from you." She slapped her palms against the wall, and then she finally blew out the lamp and left the room. In the morning, she was gone. But I was not worried. A few times in the past, when she had become angry with me, she left, but always came back. She was not at the table for breakfast either, so I knew her anger was greater than in the past. "Let her be angry then," I said to myself. "She doesn't care about my future happiness. Only mother does. That is the difference between a nursemaid and a mother." These were my very thoughts as my aunts, Gao Ling, and I followed mother to the ink-making studio to begin our work. As we entered the dim room, we all saw the mess. Stains on the walls, stains on the bench, long spills along the floor. Had a wild animal broken in? And what was that rotten, sweet smell? Then mother began to wail. "She is dead! She is dead!" Who was dead? In the next moment, I saw Precious Auntie, the top half of her face limestone white, her wild eyes staring at me. She was sitting crooked against the far wall. "Who's dead?" I called to Precious Auntie. "What happened?" I walked toward her. Her hair was unbound and matted, and then I saw that her neck was clotted with flies. She kept her eyes on me, but her hands were still. One held the knife used to carve the inkstones. Before I could reach her, a tenant pushed me aside so she could better gawk. Of that day, that was all I remembered. I didn't know how I came to be in my room, lying on the cung. When I awoke in the dark, I thought it was still the morning before. I sat up and shuddered, shaking off my nightmare. Precious Auntie was not in the cung. Then I remembered she was angry with me and had left to sleep elsewhere. I tried to fall back asleep, but now I could not lie still. I got up and stepped outside. The sky was thick with stars. No lamp burned in any room, and even the old rooster did not rustle in alarm. It was not morning, but still night, and I wondered if I was dreamwalking. I made my way across the courtyard toward the ink-making studio, thinking that Precious Auntie might be sleeping on the bench. And then I remembered more of the bad dream, black flies feasting on her neck, crawling along her shoulders like moving hair. I was scared to see what was inside the studio, but my shaking hands were already lighting the lamp. The walls were clean. So was the floor. Precious Auntie was not there. I was relieved and returned to bed. When I woke up the next time, it was morning, and Gaoling was on the edge of the cung. "No matter what," she said with a tearful face, "I promise to always treat you like a sister." Then she told me what had happened, and I listened as if I were still in a bad dream. The day before, Mrs. Chang had come over with a letter from Precious Auntie clutched in her hand. It had arrived in the middle of the night. "What is the meaning of this?" the Chang woman wanted to know. The letter said that if I joined the Chang household, Precious Auntie would come to stay as a living ghost, haunting them forever. "Where is the woman who sent this?" Mrs. Chang demanded, slapping the letter. And when Mother told her that the nursemaid had just killed herself, the Chang wife left, scared out of her wits. After that, Mother rushed over to the body, Gaoling said. Precious Auntie was still leaning on the wall in the studio. "This is how you repay me?" Mother cried. "I treated you like a sister. I treated your daughter like my own." And she kicked the body again and again for not saying thank you, sorry, I beg your pardon 1,000 times. "Mother was crazy with anger," Gaoling said. "She told Precious Auntie's body, 'If you haunt us, I'll sell Lu Ling as a whore.'" After that, Mother ordered old cook to put the body in a pushcart and throw it over the cliff. "She's down there," Gaoling said. "Your Precious Auntie is lying in the end of the world." When Gaoling left, I still did not understand everything she had said, and yet I knew. I found the pages Precious Auntie had written for me. I finished reading them. At last, I read her words. "Your mother, your mother, I am your mother." That day I went to the end of the world to look for her. As I slid down, branches and thorns tore at my skin. When I reached the bottom, I was feverish to find her. I heard the drumming of cicadas, the beating of vulture wings. I walked toward the thick brush, to where trees grew sideways just as they had fallen with the crumbling cliff. I saw moss. Oh, was that her hair? I saw a nest high in the branches. Oh, was that her body stuck on a limb? I came upon branches. Oh, were those her bones, already scattered by wolves? I turned and went the other direction, following the turn of the cliff's wall. I glimpsed tatters of cloth. Her clothes? I saw Crow carrying shreds, pieces of her flesh. I came to the wasteland with rocky mounds, 10,000 pieces of her skull and bones. Everywhere I looked, it was as if I were seeing her, torn and smashed. I had done this. I was remembering the curse of her family. My family. The dragon bones that had not been returned to their burial place. Chang, that terrible man. He wanted me to marry his son only so that I would tell him where to find more of those bones. How could I be so stupid not to have realized this before? I searched for her until dusk. By then, my eyes were swollen with dust and tears. I never found her. And as I climbed back up, I was a girl who had lost part of herself in the end of the world. For 5 days, I could not move. I could not eat. I could not even cry. I lay in the lonely Kang and felt only the air leaving my chest. When I thought I had nothing left, my body still continued to be sucked off breath. At times, I could not believe what had happened. I refused to believe it. I thought hard to make precious Auntie appear, to hear her footsteps, see her face. And when I did see her face, it was in dreams, and she was angry. She said that a curse now followed me, and I would never find peace. I was doomed to be unhappy. On the 6th day, I began to cry. It did not stop from morning until night. When I had no more feeling left, I rose from my bed and went back to my life. No more mention was ever made of my going to live with the Changs. The marriage contract had been canceled, and Mother no longer pretended I was her daughter. I did not know where I belonged in that family anymore, and sometimes, when Mother was displeased with me, she threatened to sell me as a slave girl to the tubercular old shepherd. No one spoke of precious Auntie, either once living or now dead. And though my aunts had always known I was her bastard daughter, they did not pity me as her grieving child. When I could not stop myself from crying, they turned their faces, suddenly busy with their eyes and hands. Only Gao Ling talked to me, shyly. "Are you hungry yet? If you don't want that dumpling, I'll eat it." And I remember this. Often, when I lay on my Kang, she came to me and called me Big Sister. She stroked my hand. 2 weeks after Precious Auntie killed herself, a figure ran through our gate, looking like a beggar chased by a devil. It was Little Uncle from Peking. His clothes and the hollow of his eyes were full of soot. When he opened his mouth, choking cries came out. "What's wrong? What's wrong?" I heard Mother shout as I climbed out of the root cellar. The others stumbled out of the ink-making studio. Some of the tenants rushed over as well, trailed by crawling babies and noisy dogs. "Gone," Little Uncle said. His teeth chattered as if he were cold. "Everything's burned up. We're finished."
"Burned?" Mother cried. "What are you saying?"
Little Uncle collapsed onto a bench, his face bunched into knots. "The shop on the lane, the sleeping quarters in back, everything gone to cinders." Gao Ling clasped my arm. Bit by bit, Mother and Aunt pulled the story out of him. "Last night," he said, "Precious Auntie came to Father. Her hair was unbound, dripping tears and black blood, and Father instantly knew she was a ghost and not an ordinary dream." "Liu Jinsen," Precious Auntie had called, "did you value camphor wood more than my life? Then let the wood burn as I do now." Father swung out his arm to chase her away and knocked over the oil lamp, which was not in his dream but on the table next to his cot. When Big Uncle heard the crash, he sat up and lit a match to see what had spilled onto the floor. Just then, Little Uncle said, Precious Auntie knocked the match out of his fingers. Up burst a fountain of flames. Big Uncle shouted to Little Uncle to help him douse the fire. "By Precious Auntie's trickery," Little Uncle said, "he poured out a jar of Paiga wine instead of the pot of cold tea." The fire jumped higher. Father and two uncles roused their sons from the next room. Then all the men of our family stood in the courtyard, where they watched the flames eat up the bedding, the banners, the walls. The more the fire ate, the hungrier it became. It crept to the ink shop to hunt for more food. It devoured the scrolls of famous scholars who had used our ink. It licked the silk-wrapped boxes holding the most expensive ink sticks. and when the resin of those sticks leaked out, it roared with joy. Its appetite increased. Within the hour, our family's fortunes wafted up to the gods as incense, ashes, and poisonous smoke. Mother, Big Aunt, and Little Aunt clapped their hands over their ears, as if this was the only way to keep their senses from dribbling out. "The fates have turned against us," Mother cried. "Could there be anything worse?" Little Uncle then cried and laughed and said indeed there was. "The buildings next to our family's ink shop also began to burn," he said. "The one on the east sold old scholar books. The one on the west was filled to the rafters with the works of master painters. In the middle of the orange-colored night, the shopkeepers dumped their goods into the ashy lane. Then the fire brigade arrived. Everyone joined in and tossed so many buckets of water into the air it looked like it was raining. And then it really did rain, shattering down hard, ruining the saved goods, but saving the rest of the district from being burned." By the time Little Uncle finished telling us this, Mother, my aunts, and Gao Ling had stopped wailing. They looked as though their bones and blood had drained out of the bottoms of their feet. I think they felt as I did when I finally understood that precious auntie was dead. Mother was the first to regain her senses. "Take the silver ingots out of the root cellar," she told us, "and whatever good jewelry you have, gather it up." "Why?" Gao Ling wanted to know. "Don't be stupid. The other shopkeepers will make our family pay for the damages." And then Mother pushed her. "Get up, hurry." She pulled a bracelet off Gao Ling's wrist. "Sew jewelry into the sleeves of your worst-looking jackets. Hollow out the hardest crab apples and put the gold inside those. Pile them up in the cart and put more apples on top, rotten ones. Old cook, see if the tenants have any wheelbarrows they can sell us, and don't bargain too hard. Everyone put a bundle together, but don't bother with trifles." I was amazed at how Mother's mind flowed, as if she were accustomed to running 2 paces ahead of a flood. The next day, Father, Big Uncle, and their sons came home. They already looked like paupers with their unwashed faces, their smoky clothes. Big Aunt and Little Aunt went to them, jabbering. "Will we lose the house? Will we starve? Do we really have to run away?" The smaller children began to cry. Father was like a deaf mute. He sat in his elmwood chair, rubbing its arm, declaring it the finest thing he had ever owned and lost. That night, nobody ate. We did not gather in the courtyard for the evening breezes. Gao Ling and I spent the night together, talking and crying, swearing loyalty to die together as sisters. We exchanged hairpins to seal our pledge. If she felt that precious auntie was to blame for our disasters, she did not say so, as the others had continued to do. She did not blame my birth for bringing precious auntie into their lives. Instead, Gao Ling told me that I should feel lucky that precious auntie had already died and would therefore not suffer the slow deaths of starvation and shame that awaited the rest of us. I agreed, yet wished she were with us, but she was at the end of the world. Or was she really wandering the earth seeking revenge? The next day, a man came to our gate and handed Father a letter with seals. A complaint had been made about the fire and our family's responsibility for the damages. The official said that as soon as the owners of the affected shops had tallied their losses, the figure would be given to the magistrate, and the magistrate would tell us how the debt should be settled. In the meantime, he said, our family should present the deed of our house and land. He warned us that he was posting a notice in the village about this matter, and thus people would know to report us if we try to run away. After the official left, we waited to hear from Father what we should do. He sagged into his elmwood chair. Then Mother announced, "We're finished. There is no changing fate. Today we'll go to the market, and tomorrow we will feast." Mother gave all of us more pocket money than we had held in our entire lives. She said we should each buy good things to eat, fruits and sweets, delicacies and fatty meats, whatever we had always denied ourselves but longed for. The moon festival was coming up, and so it was not unusual that we would be shopping like the rest of the crowd for the harvest meal. Because of the holiday, it was a bigger market day, with the temple fair, jugglers and acrobats, vendors of lanterns and toys, and more than the usual number of tricksters and hucksters. As we pushed through the hordes, Galing and I clung to each other's hands. We saw crying, lost children and rough-looking men who stared at us openly. Precious Auntie had constantly warned me of hooligans from the big cities who stole stupid country girls and sold them as slaves. We stopped at the stall selling mooncakes. They were stale. We turned up our noses at pork that was gray. We looked into the jars of fresh bean curd, but the squares were gooey and stunk. We had money. We had permission to buy what we wanted, yet nothing looked good. Everything seemed spoiled. We wandered about in the thick crowd, pressed one to the other like bricks. And then we found ourselves in Beggar's Lane, a place I had never been. There we saw one pitiful sight after another. A shaved head and a limbless body that rocked on its back like a tortoise on its shell. A boneless boy whose legs were wrapped around his neck. A dwarf with long needles poked through his cheeks, belly, and thighs. The beggars had the same laments. "Please, little miss, I beg you, big brother, have pity on us. Give us money, and in your next life you won't have to suffer like us." Some passing boys laughed. Most other people turned away their eyes, and a few old grannies, soon bound for the next world, threw down coins. Galing clawed at my arm and whispered, "Is that what we are destined to become?" As we turned to leave, we bumped into a wretch. She was a girl, no older than we were, dressed in shredded rags, strips tied onto strips, so that she looked as if she were wearing an ancient warrior's costume. Where the orbs of her eyes should have been, there were two sunken puckers. She began to chant, "My eyes saw too much, so I plucked them out. Now that I can see, the unseen come to me." She shook an empty bowl in front of us. "A ghost is now waiting to speak to you." "What ghost?" I asked right away. "Someone who is like a mother to you," the girl answered just as fast. Galing gasped. "How did she know Precious Auntie was your mother?" she whispered to me. And then she said to the girl, "Tell us what she says." The blind girl held up her empty bowl again and shook it. Galing threw in a coin. The girl tipped the bowl and said, "Your generosity does not weigh much." "Show what you can do first," Galing said. The girl crouched on the ground. From one tattered sleeve she pulled out a sack, and then untied it and poured its contents on the ground. It was limestone silt. From her other sleeve she removed a long, slender stick. With the flat length of the stick, she smoothed the silt until its surface was as flat as a mirror. She pointed the stick's sharp end to the ground, and with her sightless eyes aimed toward heaven, she began to write. We crouched next to her. How did a beggar girl learn to do this? This was no ordinary trick. Her hand was steady, the writing was smooth, just like a skilled calligrapher's. I read the first line. "A dog howls. The moon rises," it said. "Doggy, that was her nickname for me," I told the girl. She smoothed the silt and wrote more. "In darkness, the stars pierce forever." Shooting stars. That was in the poem Baby Uncle wrote for her. Another sweep, another line. "A rooster crows, the sun rises." Precious Auntie had been a rooster. And then the girl wrote the last line. "In daylight, it's as if the stars never existed." I felt sad, but did not know why. The girl smoothed the dirt once more and said, "The ghost has no more to say to you." "That's it?" Galing complained. "Those words make no sense." But I thanked the girl and put all the coins from my pocket into her bowl. As we walked home, Garling asked me why I had given the money for nonsense about a dog and a rooster. At first, I could not answer her. I kept repeating the lines in my head so I would not forget them. Each time I did, I grew to understand what the message was, and I became more miserable. Precious Auntie said I was the dog who betrayed her, I told Garling at last. The moon was the night I said I would leave her for the Changs. The stars piercing forever, that is her saying this is the lasting wound she can never forgive. By the time the rooster crowed, she was gone, and until she was dead, I never knew she was my mother, as if she had never existed. Garling said, that is one meaning. There are others. What then? I asked, but she could not think of anything else to say. When we returned home, mother and father, as well as our aunts and uncles, were bunched in the courtyard, talking excited voices. Father was relating how he had met an old Taoist priest at the market, a remarkable and strange man. As he passed by, the priest had called out to him, Sir, you looked as if a ghost is plaguing your house. Why do you say that? Father asked. It's true, isn't it? The old man insisted. I feel you've had a lot of bad luck, and there's no other reason for it. Am I right? We had a suicide, Father admitted, a nursemaid whose daughter was about to be married. And bad luck followed. A few calamities, Father answered. The young man standing next to the priest then asked Father if he had heard of the famous catcher of ghosts. No? Well, this is he, the wandering priest right before you. He's newly arrived in your town, so he's not yet as well known as he's in places far to the north and south. Do you have relatives in Harbin? No? Well then, if you had, you'd know who he is. The young man, who claimed to be the priest's acolyte, added, In that city alone, he's celebrated for having already caught 100 ghosts in disturbed households. When he was done, the gods told him to start wandering again. When Father finished telling us how he had met these two men, he added, This afternoon, the famous catcher of ghosts is coming to our house. A few hours later, the catcher of ghosts and his assistant stood in our courtyard. The priest had a white beard, and his long hair was piled like a messy bird's nest. In one hand he carried a walking stick with a carved end that looked like a flayed dog stretched over a gateway. In the other, he held a short beating stick. Slung over his shoulders was a rope shawl from which hung a large wooden bell. His robe was not the sand-colored cotton of most wandering monks I had seen. His was a rich-looking blue silk. The sleeves were grease-stained, as if he had often reached across the table for more to eat. I watched hungrily as Mother offered him special cold dishes. It was late afternoon, and we were sitting on low stools in the courtyard. The monk helped himself to everything. Glass noodles with spinach, bamboo shoots with pickled mustard, tofu seasoned with sesame seed oil and coriander. Mother kept apologizing about the quality of the food, saying she was both ashamed and honored to have him in our shabby home. Father was drinking tea. Tell us how it's done, he said to the priest. This catching of ghosts. Do you seize them in your fists? Is the struggle fierce and dangerous? The priest said he would soon show us. But first, I need proof of your sincerity. Father gave his word that we were indeed sincere. Words are not proof, the priest said. How do you prove sincerity? Father asked. In some cases, a family might walk from here to the top of Mount Tai and back, barefoot and carrying a load of rocks. Everyone, especially my aunts, looked doubtful that any of us could do that. In other cases, the monk continued, a small offering of pure silver can be enough, and will cover the sincerity of all members of the immediate family. How much might be enough? Father asked. The priest frowned. Only you know if your sincerity is little or great, fake or genuine. The monk continued eating. Father and mother went to another room to discuss the amount of their sincerity. When they returned, Father opened a pouch and pulled out a silver ingot and placed this in front of the famous catcher of ghosts. "This is good," the priest said. "A little sincerity is better than none at all." Mother then drew an ingot from the sleeve of her jacket. She slid this next to the first so that the two made a clinking sound. The monk nodded and put down his bowl. He clapped his hands, and the assistant took from his bundle an empty vinegar jar and wad of string. "Where is the girl that the ghost loved best?" asked the priest.
"There," Mother said, and pointed to me. "The ghost was her nursemaid."
"Her mother," Father corrected. "The girl's her bastard." I had never heard this word said aloud, and I felt as if blood was going to pour out of my ears. The priest gave a small grunt. "Don't worry, I've had other cases just as bad." Then he said to me, "Fetch me the comb she used for your hair." My feet were locked to the ground until Mother gave me a little knock on the head to hurry. So I went to the room Precious Auntie and I had shared not so long before. I picked up the comb she used to run through my hair. It was the ivory comb she never wore, its ends carved with roosters, its teeth long and straight. I remembered how Precious Auntie used to scold me for my tangles, worrying over every hair on my head. When I returned, I saw the assistant had placed the vinegar jar in the middle of the courtyard. "Run the comb through your hair 9 times, he said. So I did. "Place it in the jar." I dropped the comb inside, smelling the escape of cheap vinegar fumes. "Now stand there perfectly still." The catcher of ghosts beat his stick on the wooden bell and made a deep quack, quack sound. He and the acolyte walked in rhythm, circling me, chanting, and drawing closer. Without warning, the catcher of ghosts gave a shout and leaped toward me. I thought he was going to squeeze me into the jar, so I closed my eyes and screamed, as did Gao Ling. When I opened my eyes, I saw the acolyte was pounding a tight-fitting wooden lid onto the jar. He wove rope from top to bottom, bottom to top, then all around the jar until it resembled a hornet's nest. When this was done, the catcher of ghosts tapped the jar with his beating stick and said, "It's over. She's caught. Go ahead. Try to open it. You try. Can't be done." Everyone looked, but no one would touch. Father asked, "Can she escape?" "Not possible," said the catcher of ghosts. "This jar is guaranteed to last more than several lifetimes."
"It should be more," Mother grumbled. "Stuck in the jar forever wouldn't be too long, considering what she's done. Burned down our shop, nearly killed our family, put us in debt."
I was crying, unable to speak on Precious Auntie's behalf. I was her traitor. The next day, our family held its banquet. The best dishes. Food we would never again enjoy in this lifetime. But no one except the youngest children had any appetite. Mother had also hired a man to take photographs, so we could remember the days when we had plenty. In one, she wanted a picture of just her and Gao Ling. At the last moment, Gao Ling insisted I come and stand near Mother as well. And Mother was not pleased but did not say anything. The following day, Father and my two uncles went to Peking to hear what the damages would be against our family. While they were gone, we learned to eat watery rice porridge flavored with just a few bites of cold dishes. "Want less, regret less," that was Mother's motto. About a week later, Father stood in the courtyard, bellowing like a madman. "Make another banquet," he shouted. Then our uncles followed. "Our bad luck has ended. No damages. This was the magistrate's decision. No damages at all." We rushed toward them, children, aunts, tenants, and dogs. How could this be? And we listened as Father explained. When the other shop owners brought in their damaged goods for inspection, the magistrate discovered that one had rare books that had been stolen from the Handling Academy 30 years before. Another, who claimed he had works of master calligraphers and painters, was actually selling forgeries. The judges then decided the fire was fitting punishment to those two thieves. "The catcher of ghosts was right," Father concluded. "The ghost is gone." That evening, everyone ate well, except me. The others laughed and chatted, all worries gone. They seemed to forget that our ink sticks had